Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Beaver Banter, an Oregonian sports podcast. I'm Joe Freeman, senior writer with the Oregonian, and he's Nick Daschle, Beaver's beat writer with the Oregonian. And we're here to talk all things Oregon State. Nick, how the heck are you today, buddy?
Well, a little tired from last weekend, but I'm getting my win back.
It's not over yet, man. You're getting to the stretch run. I need you to dig deep. Dig deep.
Yeah, but there was three Friday, Saturday, Sunday games, so there won't be this week. This week's a lot easier. There are a lot of road games this week, so.
That reminds me of the, I think it was a 2000, well, I can't even remember now. It was either 11 or 12, the NBA strike year, and they had back-to-back-to-backs. There was at least a couple of those, and those were brutal. I can't imagine playing in those.
No.
yeah. I bet you could golf 3 days in a row.
Yeah, but golf isn't. Although I do walk when I play golf, I don't like to ride cart. So there's that. So
how many days in a row could you play golf?
Now or when I was
no,
playing?
Now. Oh, now.
I mean, I could still play every day if I was playing. Once I get my hands, you know, leathered up and you know, I'm not peeling my skin off my, cause I don't usually use gloves. So once my hands are good, I'm good. I mean, I played once last year. So how's that? I went out. It was the first time I played in 5 years.
Wow.
I went out.
I thought you were a big golfer.
I used to be a four handicap, and now you get married, you have kids, your back goes bad, you know, things like that. And you get busy and, yeah, I played once last year. Shot an 82 at OGA.
Not to brag, I used to be a four handicap, and I didn't play in 5 years, but I shot an 82.
Well, I'm just telling you, if I had the time to play, I'd probably kick your ass.
There is no question about that, because I am not good and have never been good at golf.
Yeah.
But I would challenge you to pick your other sport.
Yeah, I'm sure you'd kill me and everything else. So maybe pickleball, because you're not over 50 yet.
No, pickleball's fun. I haven't played in a few years, but it is it's fun. A buddy of mine used to have a little course set up in his backyard. We'd play back there every now and then.
I thought you had to be an old to play pickleball.
Haven't you heard? Pickleball's taken over the world.
I know, but it's taken over because
it's
an old man sport, old person sport.
Well, I hate to tell you this, but I'm not as young as I look, and so I'm approaching old man age.
I am looking at a dark beard, so I see there's no gray, unless you're coloring it. So
no, not yet. There's some grays flecking up in the mustache. The problem is the 8 and 5 year olds. I think by 9 and 6, it's just going to be fully gray, and you can certainly relate to that from years ago.
Yeah, well, whale are teenagers, of course. Boys,
no,
are,
thank you. No, thank you.
Yeah, except with boys. Boys are a handful from the get go. Girls wait until they're teenagers, and then they knock you off the face of the earth.
Yeah, no. I am not mentally or emotionally prepared for my children to reach age 12 yet. I have two daughters, and
well, then you're fine. There's no reason. You don't have to worry until they're like 12. Once they're 12, you know, that's when the drama starts.
Yeah. I keep hearing about these easy kids people have. Oh, yeah, my child's such an angel. I don't know easy children. That does not exist in my world. My children are lovely. I love them dearly. They're wonderful humans. There's no easy about my day to day with them. They are handfuls.
I don't know. I found it pretty easy until they got to be teenagers. Then, you know, that's when the drama starts. There's fights. Well, there's fights nonstop.
Yeah, I like I said, I'm not mentally or emotionally.
And then when
prepared,
they get to be adults, it's a crapshoot. They're still kids.
I'm excited. Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm gonna. You know what? I told myself a couple months ago that I was gonna slow down. I was gonna enjoy. You know, I don't have babies anymore. Like I said, they're 8 and 5, and you know, they're not going to be this young anymore. And I'm going to look back 10 years from now and forget about all the annoying bad stuff and only remember the fun, cute stuff. And so I'm trying to live in the moment and embrace the fun and cute right now. So I'm going to focus on that. You know, I'm going to enjoy these days and months ahead.
I don't know. My youngest daughter's always tells me, Dad, why did you let me go to school looking like that? And I don't know. Not my problem.
You're supposed to say because I had no control over anything you did.
I didn't. I had no control over any of that stuff. Although they did wear uniforms in grade school, so
no,
I didn't really.
All right. Well, we could talk about our children for an hour, but I'm sure
people want to hear about it. Do you think they'd rather hear about that than maybe they would. Yeah. I don't know.
We're here for Oregon State,
so we're going to give them Oregon State.
There you go. We're going to dish on the two hottest programs on campus. That would be the women's basketball team and the baseball team, of course. And a program that's not so hot. You guys know which one that is. Let's kind of get into the good first. And we'll start with women's basketball. Beavers are ranked 9th in the country and find themselves in a three-way tie for second place in the Pac-12 with USC and Colorado. The trio of teams are 2 games back of Stanford. Nick, how'd we get here? Let's take a step back to last weekend, that incredible victory over UCLA. For those of us who didn't attend, set the scene for us, lead us through the dramatic ending. Let's ready, set, go.
Well, how'd we get here? We got here through last year's team, really. I mean, they had to learn a lot of lessons last year. Now they're starting to grow up. And I mean, this team goes 9 or 10 deep, and it's hard to defend Oregon State right now because they have so many options, you know, at the offensive end. They've got the outside shooters. They did have Reagan Beers until an elbow on Friday night, and they've just got a lot. They've got a lot of options. And so that's where all this is coming from. What happened Friday night was it was a pretty good to very good game that just turned into an epic at the end. I mean, the Reagan Beers situation kind of got people, you know, wondering what was going to happen. Oregon State kind of hung in there. UCLA had, you know, Oregon State played enough defense to keep themselves in it. And then the finish was just incredible. I mean, 4 baskets in the last 6.6 seconds. You know, timeouts, calling a play, running it to perfection all 4 times. Oregon State had the ball last, and that's why they won. Because I think if UCLA had got the ball last, they would have won the game. That's the way that ending went. And, you know, when you're playing in front of a building that, you know, hadn't had that sort of crowd in a few years, that just made it even more special because it was loud, and it got louder at the end.
Yeah, and obviously Talia had the huge moment there. And I don't know, lead us through a little bit of what you saw from your perspective. I mean, she was pretty emotional after the game. You talked about the lumps that this team took last year to get here. And I mean, I think when you look at her career, she kind of is a poster child for kind of this 2-year stretch. But, you know, what did she have to say, and kind of what did you take away from the emotion that she showed? Not to mention just that incredible moment standing up on the courtside area there and all that.
Well, I mean, she's been through the ringer, obviously. She came here as a pretty highly touted guard out of the Tri-Cities area. She graduated early from high school. And was able to come to Oregon State in the middle of January because of the pandemic. The NCAA made an exception for that. So she comes into this team, you know, really as a high school senior playing her first year at Oregon State, steps in, plays 10, 15 games on an NCAA tournament team, lots of expectations. you know, thinking that she's going to be the one to lead this team to greatness over the next several years. And then the next last 2 years have been not so good. I mean, last year was the worst season Oregon State's had in a decade. And so, you know, I'm sure she wondered, you know, what was going on. And now it's all coming true for her at this point. She's had some moments this year where she's led the team, and Friday night is really where she hit her high with all, you know, the thing with her is, I mean, everybody's going to look at the basket that she hit, the two baskets at the end, but it's her defense that's really taken this team to another level. I mean, Scott just puts her on their best guard and she takes them out of the game. I mean, Sunday's game against, you know, USC, Juju Watkins is arguably the best player in the country. I mean, I know a lot of people think Caitlin Clark is, but shoot, Juju Watkins is, I think she's going to be a better pro than Caitlin Clark. And she held her to, I think it was 6 out of 32 shooting. I mean, she's the leading scorer in the Pac-12 with 28 points a game. And I mean, she had to work to get her 18. So yeah, there was no question that she was emotional after that Friday game, just so what happened, just based on the 4 years leading up to that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, she had the most memorable moment, obviously, but the atmosphere in general, you know, how does that moment, how does the crowd and all that kind of rank on the list of games you've attended over the years, and certainly in recent years, and just with regard to women's basketball?
Well, I mean, I would say women's basketball, I mean, it's probably the best game that Oregon State's had at Gill, mm-hmm. at least probably since the Stanford game, you know, 16, 17, I can't remember. The one they sold out, they had the bit largest crowd in school history and won, mm-hmm. where they beat Stanford. That's the only, I'm trying to remember those. It's like the only win they've had over Stanford in the last, I don't know, 15 years, maybe something like that. That one was pretty special. But I mean, for an atmosphere, oh, man, that Arizona State Oregon State men's game a few weeks ago was pretty good, but there was not quite the crowd and the stakes weren't nearly as high. It was just a, you know, your garden variety regular season midweek game as opposed to, you know, a de facto top 10 type women's basketball game. This one was way more important and it, you know, kind of lived up to the building. It's probably at Oregon State, I'd say probably the best game I've seen. Given the, you know, the atmosphere and everything.
Yeah, was what I was going to kind of wonder about was it, the stakes. You know, there's so much at stake. It was such an important weekend for a team that has, you know, significantly exceeded expectations, at least external expectations, and, you know, kind of to thrust themselves in contention for a Pac-12 championship and have these two big games at the end of the year. I just felt like the moment was, you know, it lived up to the moment. And, you know, it can only give you momentum, I would think, heading forward. That said, you know, the win did not come without a cost. Obviously, Reagan Beers suffered an injury. What's up with her? How long do we expect her to be sidelined? You know, what's the impact of her injury on what's moving forward?
Well, I mean, that was a big injury, obviously. I think they beat USC if she plays, because they have to change their offense a little bit now without her either. As far as when she comes back, I mean, they're pretty secretive around women's basketball about injuries. She's got a broken nose. My guess is Sunday she was in concussion protocol. They didn't say that, but that's my guess because she had earplugs in and she left for the locker room at halftime. Again, I'm not saying that's what I know. I'm just speculating that's what it was.
Informed speculation.
Right. I mean, my guess is if you're wearing earplugs, there's probably something going on, you know, in your head a little bit. When she comes back, you know, assuming she's clears concussion protocol, you know, she's got to get used to wearing a mask, I would guess. I don't know that we're going to see her this weekend, but I wouldn't rule it out. I don't know that you want to roll her out for her first game back against Stanford, but you know, when you're ready to go, you're ready to go. And then it's just a matter of, you know, how comfortable is she wearing a mask? Some players can deal with it. Some have difficulty with it. So I guess we'll see. You know, the big thing is you want to have her ready for the Pac-12 tournament, because that's where you can really, right now, as long as they don't, lose, say, three of their next four, they're going to still stay in a top four seed for the NCAA tournament. But if they can win three of these four, maybe even beat Stanford, and then get to the Pac-12 tournament, maybe get to the championship game, I mean, they could play their way up to a two seed. And so, but they can't really do that without Beer. They're a good to very good team without her. They're a borderline Final Four team with her.
Man, I'm all for the mask. Bring me that attitude. Give me that enforcer. You know, as this team kind of heads into its final couple of weekends here, the schedule is quite favorable. They play at Pullman, then at Seattle against UW, then they host Stanford and host Cal. So you're looking at the best team in the conference, and then, you know, three of the five worst teams in the conference. And so, you know, if there was a game for her to have to miss, it could be worse. That said, I agree with you. I don't want her just coming back for Stanford and getting thrown into the fire. I would rather her, you know, be able to work back with the mask and all that stuff against UW or Washington State. But, and this is assuming concussion is what we're dealing with, there's no rushing that back. She has to get cleared. She has to go through a series of steps to get out of the concussion protocol. So as any one of us knows who plays fantasy football, you can kind of help an ankle, or you can help a wrist or whatever, but a concussion is your brain. And so, again, assuming that's what it is, just have to be patient on that one. But as we do look for these last four games, kind of laid out what's ahead, boy, sure would be cool. Stanford might you know, eclipse that atmosphere we saw on Friday. But what's at stake kind of the next couple of weeks, the next few weeks here, Nick?
Well, you know, a couple things. It looks like the Pac-12 championship is out, because when they lost to USC, Stanford's schedule, I mean, let's be honest, their schedule is as soft as any in the Pac-12 this year. They really got a great schedule. They only have to play Colorado, Utah, UCLA, and USC, all teams that have been in the top 15 all year, once instead of twice. Oregon State plays all those teams twice. The only good team they played twice is Oregon State. So Stanford had a leg up to begin the year, and they you know, they play Arizona State at home. They should win those games running away. And then they also have Oregon and Eugene. That's another game they should win pretty comfortably. So there's not two losses left on Stanford's schedule, and that's how many Oregon State would need in order to make up the difference. So let's just say the championship's out. The next thing you're looking for is to wrap up a top four seed in the Pac-12, so you can get a first round bye in the tournament. That looks pretty good, as long as they can split in Washington. I'm not saying they have to sweep. Just split two of these last four games. I think that would be good enough, because Colorado, Utah, UCLA, and USC all play each other next weekend. That's four losses between those four teams. Those are the teams they're battling to get one of those top four. So I think as long as they can win two of the last four, they're going to get a top four seed and get a first round bye. Now, in previous years, you'd want to try to avoid playing Stanford in the Pac-12 tournament as long as you could. I'm not sure Stanford is as good as they've been in the past. So I don't know where – I don't think it really matters what seed they get, as long as they get one of those top four seeds. And that's really what they're playing for at this point. And then once you get the Pac-12 tournament in Vegas, you know, then it's just – you know, then you're just starting to look at, you know, how many games can we win? How we position ourselves for the NCAA tournament? Because they know they're in. They just want to get one of those top four seeds in the NCAA tournament so they can play at home in the first two rounds of the tournament.
Right. Okay. Well, I think we set the scene there. You know, we'll drop some haymakers later. Let's stay positive.
Speaking of dropping haymakers, Jiminy, how about the baseball team and the home runs?
Man, yeah. You know, I entered the season pretty high on this team. I kind of spent the offseason telling all of my Oregon State friends who were Oregon State alums and whatnot that that they should expect a pretty good season, that I thought it could potentially be a special season. And I have to say the Beavers had an even better opening weekend than I expected. Everybody I talked to ahead of the opener, and just, you know, with what they were returning and everything I saw in, I watched a couple scrimmages, you know, everybody thought this lineup could be very, very good. Ryan Gibson, the hitting coach, thought it could be the best in school history. And that's saying something with the 18 team and the 17 team and on down the road. But there's no way to tamp down those expectations now, man. First four games, OSU scored 42 runs and hit 14 home runs. They had a game with 7 in their opener. They had another game with 5. The 7 tied the school record. They slugged 746. Lineup is just loaded up and down with guys who have power, guys who can hit into the gap, guys who get on base. And we didn't see it a ton because we didn't have to, but it's also a very fast lineup. Multiple guys stole stolen bases, including Travis Pisano, which we'll get into in a little bit. But it was a very, surprise is surprise. It's not like they're playing, four top 25 teams. But Minnesota's a very patient offense. It draws a lot of walks. New Mexico's usually a decent second-tier program. And then Cal State Bakersfield, a slip a coin on them. And they really didn't get challenged. There was one relatively close game, and they were in command of that game for the most part, too. There was a game that it was 2-2 kind of late until they pulled away with, I think it was like 13 runs in the last two innings. So just didn't get tested, really was in command and in control the whole time. Couple quick takeaways from that offense. I wanted to look at two hitters in particular. Travis Pisano just went bonkers, and it shouldn't come as a surprise. He's going to have a special, special season. The hype about him being a top 5 pick, maybe even a number 1 pick in the NBA, MLB draft.
Pick
is
your
real.
Pro league there, Joe.
Pick your pro league, man. He's that good.
MLS, he was elected, maybe?
Yeah, MLS. Well, actually, you know what? He's an Aussie, so his second sport was always cricket growing up. Right, so let's give him the cricket nod there. But I mean, he was just ridiculous. He earned Pac-12 Player of the Week, the debut award there. He was also today, by the way, we're recording Tuesday morning, February 20th. He was named the co-national Player of the Week by Perfect Game. Through four games, he's hitting .563. He's got 3 home runs already, 7 RBIs. I mean, he is locked in. So, but that's not a surprise. Again, he entered his career with high expectations, and he has absolutely delivered on those. Another guy who entered his college career with high expectations, we are finally able to see, and I think that was the other kind of notable development offensively this weekend, and that centers around freshman third baseman Trent Carraway. He seems as good as advertised. He was kind of a top 60-ish guy in last year's MLB draft. Talked to him last week, and he said, I think he said a team reached out to him in the 3rd round to see if they drafted him, if he'd sign. And he said no. He wanted to be a day one guy. He thought he was a day one guy. And so he went to Oregon State, which was just an absolute score for them, kind of like Gavin Turley last year. After four games, his first four games, all he's doing is batting .500. He had 2 homers, 2 doubles, and he made a couple of really nice plays on defense at third base. So it's only been 4 games, and again, it's not like top tier competition, but I was really impressed with his approach at the plate, his maturity. It was kind of funny. I talked to him last week before they left and kind of asked him whether he felt, I don't know, a sense of responsibility heading into the season. He's a young dude playing with a bunch of vets. He's on a team with national championship aspirations. I kind of wondered how that would phase him, how that would affect his approach or maybe ramp up the pressure. And his response was great. He basically said, man, I'm a freshman and I have no clue. So I'm going to use that to my advantage. He's kind of like, I got nothing to lose. I have no clue. I'm just going to have fun. And he clearly had fun in surprise. The other biggest development stepping away from that, prodigious lineup was the pitching. And that was the biggest question mark coming in to the year. And keep in mind that all the pitchers are on a pretty heavily guarded pitch count, especially early in the season. And so you're not going to see a guy, you know, on his full inning count or anything like that. But there were some really encouraging developments from that standpoint. Aiden May, who is the transfer from Arizona, who is the Beavers' new ace, he was really solid in the opener, you know, kind of hit 95 and up with his fastball. He beat New Mexico, gave up just one run and four hits. But he had multiple sliders that really, kind of kept hitters off balance with that heat. Really, I think he throws five pitches and really mixed them all really well. You know, he'd had a kind of an underwhelming stats line last year at Arizona, but he played in a hitter's paradise. It was his first year in the Pac-12, and pitching coach Rich Dorman was emphatic that they think a change of scenery with a better team around him, second year in the Pac-12, and in not an insane hitter's ballpark would really increase his stock. And after one game, there's no reason not to believe him. The other couple of things, freshman Eric Segura made his first college start, and he was pretty impressive. Gave up two runs in five innings, had great pace, great control. I think he threw first pitch strikes to 17 of 21 batters he faced, really worked ahead in the count, was composed, really looked like he belonged. And that's going to be huge, as that was the biggest thing with this team last year. They had absolutely no pitching depth, and particularly starting pitching depth. Jacob Kamats, Jaron Hunter suffered late season injuries and didn't even pitch in the postseason. And so the Beavers just had no chance. And I think the staff, Dorman and everybody else, kind of had to reevaluate how they chased the transfer market, transfer portal, and tried to add to that depth. And so, you know, they went after Paul Skeens two summers ago, and, you know, he wound up at LSU because you can't compete with that NIL and other things. He came to visit Oregon State and then kind of chased the bag and ended up winning a national championship. So good on him. But they had to change who they pursued and how they approached that. And I think Aiden May was a perfect guy there. And then going back to that depth they now have, Kamats and Hunter made their long-awaited returns from injury. They were a little more up and down, worked behind in the count, threw a lot of balls, kind of labored more. Pitch count got way too high. They only went three and four innings or something like that, respectfully. But seeing them back was positive for them to return and kind of get their feet wet again after not pitching all fall and then not kind of ramping back up here during camp. So, and then behind them, bullpen was really good. For the most part, there was a couple shaky moments. Tyler Mejia was not on his game, but Bridger Holmes was electric. He's a new guy. He's a JC transfer. Freshman Drew Talav struck out the side in his only appearance. AJ Lattery, the chiseled vet, was great. Kyle Scott was a little erratic in his first save chance, but he did close the game. And then from kind of an inspirational standpoint, Joey Munt, hard-throwing right-hander, made his first appearance after missing the last 2 years recovering from elbow surgery. He pitched a scoreless inning, struck out two, so it was nice to kind of see him back on the hill. I know there's multiple readers who have been emailing me about him the last couple of years, so I'm sure they'll be happy to see him back as well. Wrapping up the baseball section of this podcast here, Nick, I should preface all that with it's only been four games, man. We got 50 more to go. It's the Beavers always play well in surprise. The bigger test will come immediately. That's this week. They're going to play at the home of the Texas Rangers in Arlington, Texas, and they've got a doozy of a four-game schedule. They open with Texas Tech later this week, kind of a midweek game. And then they play number two Arkansas, Michigan, and Oklahoma State. Oklahoma State opened the year ranked, and it kind of lost a couple games this opening weekend, so we'll see how they are. But a really nice test there in their second weekend of the regular season. So, Nick,
I think is a Tech in the top 20. I know, yeah, they just beat Oregon last weekend, didn't they?
Texas Tech's ranked 19th. Yeah. And there's five polls, but we use the D1 baseball poll, and so they're number 19 there. The Beavers are number 7. So the Arkansas game in particular will be 2-7, and that'll be really fun because I imagine against Texas Tech they're going to kind of show their midweek lineups and play their start their midweek guys, both teams. I wouldn't be surprised if that was AJ Lattery who just worked like an inning and a third over the weekend, but we'll see. They're pretty guarded on their rotation sometimes. So we'll see how that pans out. But that number two or that Arkansas OSU game should feature both aces and it should really be a fun
that,
one.
Is that game televised at all?
It's on Flow Sports, which is kind of a streaming thing you have to subscribe to. My understanding is that's where all the games will exclusively be.
So a couple things I was going to circle back on, well, not at least one of them. So the home run, you said 16, right? Over
14.
14, okay. That just seems like a lot to keep up to, but I'm wondering, do they have any holes in their lineup? Because that's typically where you would – that's typically how these things would start to fall off. You found those holes, you could pitch around guys. Do they not have anybody in the entire lineup that they can, that teams will pitch around and, you know,
they really don't. I mean, the only kind of, you know, I don't want to say negative because it's four games, but the minor, you know, discouragement this weekend was Elijah Hainlein. He's a transfer from Washington State, kind of took over at shortstop. And, you know, Kyle Durnetti manned that spot the last two and a half years. An incredible defender, arguably the best defensive shortstop in college baseball last year in particular. And but really struggled to even hit 200. And so they really wanted an offensive upgrade. They got Elijah Hainlein from Washington State after he hit double digits home runs, batted over 300. And, you know, he batted under 100 for the opening weekend. So, you know, someone who's looking on paper at this team would say he's their guy that you might be able to exploit. But, I mean, shoot, he batted fifth in the lineup. So they view him very highly. And it's probably just a cold four games. He did hit a home run, you know, so he did produce, but you know, other than that, didn't do much.
I need to see more than four games before I write a guy off
like
that.
Absolutely. 100%. And you know, that's the caveat with all this. Yeah. They hit 14 home runs, but it was four games. But that said, it took them nine games to get to 14 home runs last year, and they set the school record with 89 home runs. So that gives you an indication of the, you know, the potential of this lineup. But back to your, you know, are there any holes? No, there really aren't. You've got so many veterans with Bazana and Micah McDowell and, you know, Mason Guerra, Brady Casper. Those guys have played a lot of baseball games, and that doesn't even talk about Gavin Turley, who's a future first round, you know, draft pick, who led the team in homers last year. Their catching duo, Tanner Smith, had an excellent opening weekend. Wilson Weber, who got a lot of hype for what he did in the fall and what he's done in camp, I don't think he had a hit. So that was kind of a discouraging opener for him, but he only played in two games. So that's really just two games. So to your question, no, I do not see, you know, a lot of holes in this lineup. And where the team struggled last year, beyond just being less talented than they normally are, less experienced than they normally are, and having that lack of pitching depth, was they went through a really cold stretch, kind of early spring, late, you know, February into March, or heading into March. And I think they were batting 200 or 100, and I can't even remember now, but it was roughly 200 in Pac-12 play, or it was like 161, I think. So it was a huge slump. And I don't think this team goes into a slump like that. Even when one or two or even three guys are scuffling, the other guys are going to kind of pick up the slack. Caraway, who's the guy I mentioned earlier, is batting number nine. So when you guys have a guy who's hitting 500 batting, you know, in the nine hole, he's got two home runs and two doubles, I think you're doing okay.
The other thing, I was going to circle back on anything you talked about now, but a story you wrote about Pat Casey. A really good story. People should read that on Oregon Live.
Thanks.
I was wondering. I'm reading through this story, and you wrote all these things that Pat did as motivational, and I'm wondering, could Pat Casey coach baseball in 2024? Could a guy like that coach that style in 2024 with the transfer portal and all that? You didn't cover him, obviously. I really didn't do much with him, but I'm just curious I mean, because Mitch is obviously a entirely different coach than than Pat is, and Pat, he's old school. I just wonder, do you think he could do it in this era?
It's a really good question. It does make you wonder. A couple things come to mind when hearing that. Two things I didn't mention in the story. I mean, the story was already so long, I just couldn't get everything in there. I could write two more stories with I talked to over a dozen guys. So, one thing that I thought was interesting is everybody said, you know, Pat Casey really evolved over his 3-4 decades, whatever it was, coaching. And he was, you know, even harder on guys at the beginning. And then there was kind of this first decade in this Casey and the second decade Casey. And then by the end, he had softened quite a bit. And, you know, I think one of the anecdotes I relayed was from Mitch Canham and Darwin Barney, who are like, you know, Casey's sitting in the dugout in Omaha during an intense game in the College World Series. And Darwin looks over at Mitch and is like, should we flick his ear? And so they both kind of went up and flicked his ears. And, you know, I think first decade Casey would have turned around and slugged one of those dudes, or at least threatened to. But instead, he kind of looked back and kind of smirked when he saw who it was. And I don't know if his style would fly now, but he did have an evolution in which he was much more, at least by Pat Casey's standards, gentler by the end. But man, that dude was so intense, and he's such a competitive dude, and it had such a competitive, you know, nature just probably at birth, that there's only so much you can do to stifle that. But on the other thing I was going to mention that I didn't get in there is everyone said he had this presence that, you know, you could be in the cages focused on a pitcher, or you could be doing a bullpen or wherever, and you didn't know he was there, but you felt him approach, and all of a sudden something changed and you just knew, oh shit, Pat Casey's here. And, you know, there, Mitch Canham kind of described it as one time when he was in the minors and he was in spring training, Muhammad Ali walked into the locker room and it was like, wait, what's that? And you just felt when Muhammad Ali's presence was there, because he was the greatest. And, you know, Pat Casey had a similar kind of feeling. And so, you know, even to the day, if Pat shows up to an Oregon State practice, or if the players know that Pat Casey's going to be there, they sit up taller, they focus more. And so I wonder if just his status and what is he has accomplished would still carry over into coaching, because you're right, it's a different generation guys are coaching now. I mean, they're scoring over 200 points in an NBA All-Star game or whatever it was. And so it's just a different deal. But I don't know, to answer your question. What do you think?
It always goes back to all the Oregon State fans that reach out to me about how bad men's basketball is. And, you know, they always want to bring up Ralph Miller. And I think, yeah, Ralph was great in his day, but I don't know whether he could coach these guys today or not. I don't know whether his style would work at all. And I mean, you got to at least think, okay, these guys are smart enough to know they probably need to adapt, but could they adapt enough and still be effective? That's unknowable. But I mean, I kind of think Pat would probably figure it out, but I just don't. It's hard to know. I mean, you certainly couldn't get away with some of the stuff that he did way back in the day, for sure. Because, you know, guys will transfer. They just, you know, they don't want to go through the adversity. They just don't.
And you know, another thing comes to mind is everybody I talked to said he handled everybody differently, and he knew how to read personalities, and he kind of picked guys to just kind of verbally undress, or to choose to single out as kind of a message to the whole team. And he did so because he knew those particular guys could handle it. You know, I keep bringing up Darwin and Canham, but, you know, Casey went hard at Mitch Canham because he knew that's what he needed and he knew he could handle it. He didn't necessarily do that to Darwin, Darwin said. He didn't really have these blow-ups at him. In fact, there was one story I told him there where Darwin, his freshman year, he goes in after 2 or 3 weeks, he's kind of in a slump and he's batting in the three hole and goes in before the game to talk to Coach Case, and he's like, hey, man, if you need to move me down in the order, take me out of three hole, I totally understand. Don't feel like you have to do it for me. And Casey's like, well, I'm going to move you down today because you came and brought it up, but you're going to hit. And so he had a different approach with him. And I don't know. I think maybe because of how he reads guys, he kind of would be able to navigate that a little more. But you're absolutely right, man. With the transfer portal, you just can't be messing around, because a guy could leave practice on a Tuesday and be on a new team, you know, a month later or whatever. So,
yeah,
it's definitely a balancing act these days. There's no balancing what's going on with the Oregon State men's basketball team. Now that we've kind of, I guess, focused on the positives going on around campus now, let's shift to the blah men's hoops. Beavers are last in the Pac-12, and they're going out with a whimper. Nick, the season's toast, right?
Well, depends on what your expectations were going into the year. I always thought that the, you know, best case scenario for this team is to get somewhere near 500. And I think deep down, that's what Wayne probably thought too. I mean, he wanted to show some progress this year, because he'd been emphasizing, I brought in all these new guys last year. We're building this up for a 2 or 3 year period, and we get to the third year, that's when we'll be pretty good. I don't know, in college basketball you can do that anymore, but you know, that was what Wayne sold, you know, Scott Barnes on, and so that's where they're going. They're 11-15 right now. They've got, you know, they're on a 6-game losing streak, so to think that they can win some of these games and get back to 500 by the end of the year seems a bit of a stretch. But they head down to the Bay Area this week for Cal and Stanford. Both games, you know, teams that they could beat if they played well, but they are road games. Then they have Oregon at Oregon. That's going to be difficult, even though they almost won Saturday night against the Ducks. And then they finish at home against Colorado and Utah. So, I mean, if, like I wrote about over the weekend, it's these 6 to 8 minute stretches in a game that kills them. They've lost a bunch of winnable games this year because they just, for whatever reason, just completely forget how to play for about 6 to 8 minutes. The rest of the game, they're pretty good. So if they can get rid of, at least maybe knock that down to 2 minutes or something like that, or just get rid of them altogether, maybe they can win a few of these games. Can they get, I think the goal has got to be try to get as close to 15 wins as possible. I think if you can get to 15 wins, hold on to this roster for next year, play in the WCC, I think they got something. But they got to start winning some of these games. They got to start turning around. It's not one thing either. It's like, when they go bad everywhere. And when they're playing well, they play well on both ends of the floor. Their post play is killing them a little bit. Casey Obekwe, he just hasn't evolved this year at all. And, you know, try and show Mariall a little bit, the 7-2. He's listed as a senior, but I still think he's got another year of eligibility left. He started against the Ducks and had some moments, but the post play is killing them, and they need to find ways to get Pope going a little bit more in games. Cause when he gets going, he can really fill it up. I don't know. I mean, if they finish the regular season with 11 game losing streak, lose the last game, I don't know what you do, cause they're stuck. I don't know.
Yeah, here's my problem is they have 3 wins, man. And it's not like in conference, and it's not like the Pac-12 is just having this, you know, ridiculously dominant season. I mean, Arizona's very good, and I think they have 2 ranked teams maybe right now. So it's not like they're just playing this murderer's row, you know, every week. And so you have to, with your, what you're talking about with this 2-3 year plan, you have to show growth and evolution and kind of instill some hope. And so, I mean, I look at these last 4 or 5 games as, you know, vitally important, because you just can't end the conference season with 3 wins. And like you said, 11 losses in a row. And so, I mean, I don't know what you do at this point.
Well, you can even sell 11-15 if all the losses were solid down to the wire type ones. But the problem is they've had several games they've lost by 20 plus points. So those are the situations where you go, is this team really getting any better? They can't have any more of those. They just, even if they lose these last five, they can't have any more of those. They got to be in the game to the end. At least I've seen a lot of these teams where when they have a season like this, they're really competitive, but they don't lose. They bring everybody back, and the next year is pretty good. I've seen that quite a bit. Whether they can do that, I don't know. But they can't. They got to stop getting blown out. That's happened way too many times this season. That's probably been the most disappointing part of this team is the number of blowouts they've been on the back end of.
The most dangerous thing with fandom and with a passionate following of any sports program, professional or college, isn't being angry about a program and being upset with the direction. It's apathy. And I sense that the men's basketball program right now, the fans they're just apathetic about it. They just are indifferent because they've come to expect what's happening, and they don't see, you know, hope on the horizon. And so rather than be angry about a loss because they were expecting a competitive game or a win, they just don't care. And from my perspective, after all these years of doing this, that is a death blow for a coaching staff, for a program, and on down the line. And so, I mean, obviously Oregon State's financial situation is what it is with its conference and all that stuff. But again, when people don't care, that's the biggest problem.
Well, and the worst thing that's happened to Oregon State this year is what's happened at Washington State. You know, they were pretty good last year, lost pretty much all their good players. Kyle went out and retooled the whole roster. Doesn't have a great situation with NIL, and look where they're at. They're one game out of first place and probably going to go to the NCAA tournament. And so fans look at Washington State and go, why can't we be that? You know, why can't we do that? And that's a fair question. Wayne decided to go in a different direction, but still, you know, that's a question fans are going to ask. Why couldn't we have just hit the transfer portal and brought in a bunch of these guys? I guess the answer could also be, well, Oregon State tried that the year after the Elite Eight, and look what happened. they got a bunch of guys that they got a bunch of transfers that didn't work out. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's a different situation.
Because of COVID and not being able to build relationships and do right. their due diligence.
Yeah, that was a factor. Yeah, that was a factor. So,
all right. Well, before we get out of here, Nick, the great Nick Daschle has a rule change he wants to propose. Let's get into it, Nick. What do you got for us?
Well, I don't know if I have a rule change so much. It's just men's basketball is the one of the three people most pay attention to. You know, the NBA, women's college basketball, men's college basketball. They're the one sport that doesn't advance the ball late in games after timeouts to midcourt. And as you saw against the UCLA Oregon State women's game, what a boost that does to the end of game situations. And you saw what happened with the Oregon State men's game, where Oregon scores with 1 second left to take the lead. Oregon State's got to go the length of the floor in a second. Impossible. But had they got the ball at midcourt, Oregon State women were in the same situation Friday night, 1.1 seconds left, and they got a game winner. Oregon State men weren't in that situation. I mean, college basketball has got to figure out this is still it's an entertainment business. You got to make, I mean, I get that, you know, the purists say, well, you should have to go the length of the floor in any situation. Well, it seems to work in the NBA just fine, and it works for women's basketball. I'm not sure why college men's basketball is the same situation. And the other thing the men do is they only play two halves instead of four quarters, which I guess.
No, don't excuse it. Don't excuse it.
Well, some people would go, well, that's six and one, half a dozen of them. But the difference is for women, they play four quarters. They have five fouls in each quarter. Men mm-hmm. go seven fouls. And then you go to 1-1 until 10. Well, that one and one is a killer in men's basketball, because a lot of times you end up sending a post to the free throw line and a 1-1, they miss the front end and the possessions toast, and the women, they don't have one-on-ones. The NBA, they don't have one-on-one. So I think that's another one that they could look at just to make a little bit more of an entertaining game. I know what a big fan of college basketball you are, Joe. So
Don't get me started. I took my 8-year-old. She started playing basketball for the first time. She's played in about 4 games. I'll tell you, there's nothing like watching an 8-year-old girls basketball game. It's incredible. I took her over to a Pilots game a couple weeks ago. She absolutely loved it. We had a blast. But I was reminded that why the heck are they playing 2 halves? It makes no sense. Every other level of basketball around the world plays 4 quarters. It's a 4-quarter game. My Tuesday night basketball game, well, we play 4 quarters. It's a different kind of a setup. But, I mean, even at our level, old man idiot game, we play 4 quarters. And I agree with you on the you should get the ball at half court. I mean, it's a no-brainer. It creates more drama. I mean, I can think of one iconic play in all my years of watching basketball, Grant Hill to Christian Laettner. Other than that, I mean, and that was a miracle. It takes a miracle. It doesn't necessarily take a miracle, you know, to inbound the ball and run a set even with seconds left.
Oregon State and UCLA scored twice in 2.2 seconds because they were able to have the ball at half court.
Exactly.
Do you coach your 8-year-old team?
No.
See, I did. Yeah. I coach both my daughters, third grade team. Oh, nice. Do they have the 8-foot rim, 9-foot rim?
No. They do full 10-foot rim. So there's a ton of air balls if they even get shots off, but they do use a smaller ball. So I don't know.
Well, please tell me that the league doesn't allow zone defenses.
There's no zone defenses. You can't double team. And in fact, you can't play full court defense, although there's some teams that skirt that rule. But you're just supposed to let them bring up the ball until they get to half court, and then you can play defense. So,
third grade basketball, man, that was – I remember I had this one girl on our team. She used to skip up the floor. And we'd go, Maria, this is basketball. You run up the floor. You don't skip.
We haven't had any skipping, but Coach Chris is a genius. He hands out 50 cents for every steal and block. And so my daughter, Finley, she just chases steals all day because she wants to bring home those dugouts. So, you got to motivate them how you got to motivate them. But it's fun. And they play 4 quarters of basketball on that note. And I think we solved all the ails here. Is there anything before we get out of here, Nicholas?
Nope. 2 weeks to football.
2 weeks to spring football. You know, maybe the next pod or the one after that, we'll do a little spring preview, depending upon how it sets up with that. It's March 5th, right? Is the spring opener?
March 5th, Tuesday, March 5th. That's why it's exactly 2 weeks from. In fact, they'll be getting close to wrapping up their first practice just as we're finishing up this pod. So
there you go, and we'll go ahead and finish up this pod on that note. Thank you so much for listening. We had to move from Monday to Tuesday this week because there was a baseball game yesterday, but we're going to try to stick to Mondays moving forward. So enjoy your week of Oregon State sports, and we'll talk to you next week. Take care.